Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Filling in tonight for my friend and colleague George Norrie, who is visiting his family in St. Louis. And since I am temporarily sitting here in the big chair, it means I am working with the A-team tonight. Dan and Sean and Tom, all the other folks at Premier. It's an absolutely gorgeous night here in the desert. I've got my atomic testing museum mug filled with hot Joe, thinking to myself, heck, we've all got the day off tomorrow. We can all sleep in, which means you can stay up late with us, get some things off your chest if you're so inclined. So folks, put on a pot, sink into that easy chair, and settle in for a late night devoted to the exploration of dark mysteries, weird happenings, conspiracy theories. Well, you know better than I what the parameters are here, so let's have some fun, stretch our minds a bit, take that brain out for a spin. We'll have 3 full hours of open lines, of course, this being Friday evening, starting an hour from now. In this first hour, though, a subject near and dear, Area 51, the world's best-known non-existent military base, once obscured in secrecy, hidden out there in the desert, known only to those who live near it or who work there, and known by so many names, Dreamland, The Ranch, The Box, Groom Lake, and the designation that's now known all over the world, the name that's launched so many books and movies and TV shows, news reports. I mean, every major news organization in the world has been out there at one time or another. Merchandise, from T-shirts and shot glasses to UFO model kits, a couple of bars named for this place, rock bands, a professional baseball team, the extraterrestrial highway, and who knows what else. I'm talking, of course, about Area 51. It burst onto the public's radar screen back in 1989 when a guy named Bob Lazar came forward and told some tales. And from there, it's just exploded and still gathering steam. Its latest incarnation is in the form of an interactive exhibit in a national museum, the Atomic Testing Museum here in Las Vegas. This exhibit opens to the public Monday. I was given a sneak peek earlier this week, and I put together a little TV news report about it. If you want to get an idea what this looks like in preparation for our conversation, what's included in the museum, you can click on the link in our Knapp's News section on the Coast to Coast website. Check it out. In just a minute or so, we are joined by two people who were instrumental in making this exhibit a reality. And I have a feeling it was not an easy sell for them, not all the way anyway. Alan Palmer is the director of the Atomic Testing Museum. You may have heard him chatting with George Norrie earlier this month. Tonight, I think we explore a little further into the challenges that came along with putting a controversial topic like this into a highly respected museum. Also here is Karen Green, the curator of the Atomic Museum. She's been doing the hands-on work, getting down and dirty, gathering materials, weaving it all together into a cohesive theme, and most importantly, making it fun, because it certainly is that. Do these museum professionals have any trepidation, any reservations about tackling something as controversial as this? How much grief have they endured from their fellow museum bigwigs? How big of a hit might they have on their hands? We're going to get into all of that and more. I'll have some news items of interest to you, plus more about our Knapp's News item section, consisting of stories and oddities that Sean and I thought might be fun to chat with you all about tonight. Check them out when you get a moment. We'll get into some detail about those stories at the top of the next hour. Time now, though, for our first break. When we come back, Area 51, Myth or Reality, with Alan Palmer and Karen Green. Let's cut loose tonight. Let it all hang out. I'm George Knapp, in for George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Thanks for being with us tonight. I'm George Knapp, in tonight for my friend George Norrie. We're joined now by Commander Alan Palmer, who is a third-generation Air Force officer. He flew F-4s, he was telling me the other day. Went to the U.S. Air Force Officer Training School, commissioned a second lieutenant back in the 60s, and then got into the museum work. Has held senior management positions, including at the San Diego Aerospace Museum. Currently executive director and CEO of the National Atomic Testing Museum here in Las Vegas, which is one of only 37 national museums in America. And Karen Green is the curator of that museum. She's in charge of collections, exhibits, grant writing, and chief cook and bottle washer. I think Karen does just about everything there. Alan and Karen, thanks for being with us. I know you've had a long week here.
George, it's good to be with you from beautiful Las Vegas.
Hello, George. Good to be with you.
Hey, the two of you had a VIP event tonight. You had a media night the other night. What's the feedback like so far?
Well, it's absolutely great. The event tonight was all clad in very yellowish-green glow, and we had everybody from the mayor to Congress people to an alien warrior comic, a Las Vegas showgirl, you name it. Even a flash mob showed up tonight. So I guess it's fair to say, George, we had a little bit of everything here. Sorry you missed it.
And what are they saying about it? What are they saying about what they've seen?
Universally amazed. That includes the press, but also everybody who saw it. Even our friend Robin Leach showed up tonight. And Robin was just totally blown away.
Robin Leach probably accompanied by three or four blondes.
Absolutely.
Karen, do you remember the exact moment when you thought, hey, this is a good idea, when you thought this is doable?
You know, actually, I did, and that was right after the Roadrunners came for their first symposium, and they started talking about all of the things that people didn't know about. And I thought, you know, this is a great exhibit. And when we started working on it, eventually we decided we needed to tell both sides of the stories, the myth and the reality.
Myth meaning, do you think it's not true?
Well, no, not that it's not true. It's just that there's a lot of myths that swirl around Area 51, mostly from pop culture. And so we wanted to make sure that we could look at those particular things and say, what is true about those myths? What do we know about those myths? Is there any scientific facts for those myths? And put that out there.
Alan, you're a third-generation Air Force guy. You travel in military circles. A lot of the primary sponsors of the Atomic Testing Museum are these big defense contractors. I'm just curious whether you've caught any heat about this. Have these guys said, why are you paying attention to this crazy UFO stuff?
Well, no, George, not yet, but the mailbox isn't full yet. I expect we'll probably receive a few letters. But here's the thing, as Karen indicated, you know, we wanted to tell this story from the aspect of what's really true and what's known now, because a lot of that information about Area 51 and DOD CIA involvement has been declassified. But the other side of that question begged to be told. And I knew that if we didn't tell it, we'd probably open ourselves up to criticism. So what we chose to do was to present both sides and let people kind of decide for themselves how they're going to interpret that.
But at some point you had to think, man, this could really blow up in my face here. I mean, I could be a laughingstock among my museum colleagues because, I mean, frankly, and I hear it every day, a lot of people just think this is a bunch of baloney. Bob Lazar, Element 115, flying saucers, aliens.
Well, the thing with the museum world, and it's unique probably to the museum world, is as long as you're the honest broker, as long as you approach it from a factual basis, then you're okay. The problem becomes when you start taking sides. So that's what we're trying diligently to do here, is present the evidence and present sides of a story, and then let people decide. And you're right, frankly, the side that deals a lot with Hollywood product, books, documentaries, is not exactly proven, but we felt that we needed to get it out there because just because it is out there means that it is a fact of life, and we can't ignore that. So we're trying to diligently pursue both sides.
And Karen, same sort of question for you. In the museum world, I mean, I would think that's a small world that you all talk to each other. Are you getting any ribbing, people joking about it, giving you some grief?
You know, one of the comments I got today is, God, Karen, you have the coolest job ever because we were opening Area 51. So a lot of people are really intrigued by the fact that we're able to present this in the way that we're presenting it, and that we've gotten lots of experts to deal with this story on both sides of it. So, you know, I think most museum people are going to look at this and say, wow, they have the artifacts, they have the facts. And, you know, as a museum person, we tend to walk kind of that middle of the road. So we've really looked at what is true, what isn't true, and then we're going to lay it out there and let people decide for themselves.
Alan, let's broaden the subject a little bit to the larger UFO issue. You were an Air Force guy. There must have been conversations at some point in your career as a pilot about strange things in the sky. You told me the other day you had never seen one personally, but you do know people who had.
That's very true, George, and I've got a couple of friends who I know are highly reliable people. These are guys who were certified in nuclear weapons programs of the highest background checks and mental stability. These are not flaky people, and yet they had experiences where they had seen something and really believed it was true.
And you've never seen one, though, yourself?
Well, I haven't, but I do know, and I've flown in the same flight with other people who have seen things that they can't explain. One of them had to do with flying over North Vietnam at night. The star Venus at night is very bright, and because it's stationary and you're moving, it can look like a flying saucer or a light in the sky that's dancing around. And a lot of guys would come back and report something they had seen like that. Turns out that's what it was. We'd all go, come on, yeah, that's Venus. Oh, okay. That was usually new people in the area. Once they got used to it, they go, oh, yeah, okay, I see.
But as a military guy, as someone who's been around, has a lot of military friends, you are open-minded on the subject in general?
Well, I really am. The universe is bold and huge, and it's inconceivable to me that there's not life somewhere out there. The problem is that life that can travel? Is it life that can manifest itself in our world? That's an even much bigger probability issue.
And Karen, sort of the same question. You know, in the world of academics, and I'm putting you folks in that category, museums and dealing with the academic type questions. University professors, folks like that, generally pretty hostile to the UFO topic, and not in a fair way. They don't want to hear both sides of it. They just don't want to hear that UFO stuff at all.
Well, you know, I think it's where the university professor's from, too. I lived many years in the Big Bend of Texas, and out there were many unexplained phenomena, including the Marfa lights, and professors were actually studying some of that. So I think that there are open-minded academics who are going to look at this, just like they're open-minded scientists who are going to look at it, and they're going to actually say, well, what can we prove, what can't we prove, and what should we be able to prove?
Well, I hope you're right, because I've had just the direct opposite of an experience with academics across the country who just don't want to hear this stuff at all.
Well, George, you know, I really think it's time that we have a place, a forum somewhere where people can come and they can actually talk about this. And they can talk about it without maybe the fringe, but they can talk about it in the middle with the science and the technology. And what do we need to do to find out? Do UFOs exist? And, you know, what are they?
Have you thought about sort of the long-term picture? I mean, the effects this could have, making it somehow respectable to discuss this stuff in an open way, well, that people of science, people with legitimate backgrounds can take it and look at it honestly and openly?
Absolutely. And again, if we can be the honest broker in this, it's a primary mission for a museum to be able to get people to honestly look at both sides of it.
And Alan, for you, I mean, it is a nice fit with the Atomic Testing Museum. Is there concern that it overwhelms that, or you're pretty sure it's going to attract more attention to it? Because, I mean, people across the country who don't know about this museum, it's just very cool. I mean, not everybody has an atomic testing facility in their backyard where they blew up dozens, scores of atomic weapons above ground, below ground, and it's just such a cool place.
Well, the Area 51 story is exactly complementary to the story of testing nuclear weapons here in the desert. If you think about it, the word testing and nuclear shows up in both places. The testing that was done at Area 51 was done so that we would know that we could prove a technology that could go spy on the Soviets before satellites and find out what they were doing with their nuclear weapons testing program. So those two things fit almost perfectly like hand in glove.
Well, in history, of course, they did complement each other a lot. The Area 51 being tucked out there in that spot, sort of surrounded by the test site, and the Nellis Range was protected from prying eyes because of the other facilities that were out there. At the same time, though, there were a lot of flare-ups between the two operations because atomic testing fallout would float over the base in the early days, cause all kinds of problems.
Yeah, you can imagine they would be a little upset over at Area 51 getting ready to take off on a U-2 when someone was getting ready to set a bomb off underneath them.
Karen, why don't you go ahead and describe for our listeners what's in the museum? I guess you want to hold back some of the secrets, but give them a general feel for what they would see.
Well, basically, when you go in, it's an experience. You know, for Area 51, it really, we try to take them there. We try to immerse them in the place. Everybody wants to go up the extraterrestrial highway. They want to go to the gate. They want to meet that camo dude and see what happens. And so when they come into this exhibit, they actually are going to become part of Area 51. They're going to have that experience. And we take them back into the area. We give them their mission, and we send them on their way to explore what about Area 51 is myth and what is reality.
Is there anything missing that you wanted to have in there?
You know, there were probably lots of things we would have loved to put in, but, you know, we can only scratch the surface on some things. We decided to go with some larger pictures as we went through, and with basically we wanted to deal with some of the science and technology and the facts behind the myth as well as the reality.
You know, the Roadrunners, as you mentioned earlier, are a key component of the exhibit, and they had a very successful event there several months ago. You mentioned was part of the impetus for this thing, and of course they're a key part of this. Their story is an important one to tell. The guys who worked on the U-2, SR-71, and A-12, I mean, they're American heroes. They helped win the Cold War, and they labored in obscurity, couldn't even tell their own spouses what they did, put their lives on the line. It's an important story. In general, though, Alan, they're kind of hostile. If not hostile, they're not very supportive of the whole UFO scenario. Is there any problem of the two of them coexisting in the same exhibit?
Well, I don't think so, because some of the story of UFOs, again, unidentified flying objects, some of those unidentified flying objects were actually the aircraft that they were working on out at Area 51. The U-2, when it was first introduced, was not painted black yet, was silver, and flying at 70,000 feet plus on a bright sunny day without contrails looked like the spaceship going, the silver bullet going through the sky. So that was easily mistaken for a spaceship, but no one could talk about what that was. Had we done so, we would have given away to the Soviets our capability to fly that high and fly that way undetected.
Well, T.D. Barnes and some of his colleagues, I've got to know them fairly well, did the first interviews with them. I have the utmost respect for them as men, as Americans, as patriots. I mean, they've done some incredible work. But, you know, they do get a little hot under the collar when the UFO part of it gets more attention. I think at some point they've realized, though, that because of the stories of Bob Lazar, Area 51 is on the map. It may have even helped provide impetus for the declassification of their stories. You know, well, I think they've come to a happy place about it in some regards.
Well, think about it this way, you know, and TD and his colleagues out there will be the first to admit it. Their information and their projects were very compartmentalized. They had a small piece of a big puzzle, and they didn't have the knowledge of the rest of it. For instance, when they were testing the stealth fighter, the F-117, they would do that at night. The guys on the ramp on the other side of the hangars were doing daytime ops. They had no idea what was going on at night. And so it's conceivable that those guys could spend years out there, if not their whole careers, and not know some of the other things that were happening out there.
Well, I've heard them say it. You know, they would be standing in the chow line, see the same guy day after day, week after week for months, and never know what that guy was doing for a living, what he was working on out there. So, you know, I've kidded TD and some of the other guys when you say that there were no UFOs, you didn't see any saucers or aliens. How do you know they weren't out there? Because you weren't supposed to know what everything was going on.
Exactly.
I want to get into talking about merchandise, because that's also I was in the gift shop there, Karen, the other day, and you always had cool stuff in there, atomic testing related stuff, but it's changed. The flavor has changed quite a bit. Are you there, Karen?
Yes, I am. Yeah, we have a whole lot of things that have been developed for this exhibit. We've branded some things. We have stuff on both sides.
I'll tell you what, that music is telling me we need to take a break. You think about the merchandise stuff. We'll give them a little teaser there and come back after the break. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come. I'm George Knapp in for George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm talking with Alan Palmer and Karen Green from the Atomic Testing Museum here in Las Vegas, creators of the new Area 51 exhibit. I got a feeling they're going to have a big hit on their hands. Earlier this week, after I had a little sneak peek walkthrough, I sent a note to none other than Bob Lazar and his friend Gene Huff. Lazar has indicated to me he wants to come out and see it for himself. That would be a kind of a cool little event. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines with your questions for my guests. Top of the hour, we'll open it up to any kind of topic at all. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the merchandise that's now on sale at the museum. It's a lot different from what it used to be. I'm George Knapp, in tonight for George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. During the break, got an email from one of our listeners who apparently used to be out at Area 51, sent me some photos that were taken at the base back in 1959. Very cool stuff. If I can get them up on the website, I will. Karen, before the break, we were talking about how the nature of the merchandise you're selling has changed. I mean, it certainly has a more alien flavor.
Well, it does. And I mean, it has everything from road signs to inflatable aliens to our own branded T-shirts. We have postcards. Today we got in a limited edition Area 51 alien. So, I mean, there's just a whole lot of things, and there's a lot of airplanes and, of course, merchandise that is only available one other place, which is at the CIA that deals with the Oxcart program.
Well, you've been to my house, Karen. You know that I don't need any more Area 51 stuff, but I got a feeling I'm going to be there shopping real soon again.
I think so, George.
Are you worried at all about I use this term not in a derogatory way, but UFO nuts. I mean, people just being crazy and getting out of hand.
You mean in the exhibit or just coming in?
Yeah, at the exhibit.
Well,
yeah.
You know, we've all probably got our little aluminum foil hats in our pockets. You know, we've had a couple people who've come in who've actually firmly believe in the kind of UFO alien encounter type things. We try to treat them with respect, and we listen to what they have to say. And I don't think they'll get out of hand. I'm not sure, though, you know. I'm sure that in some cases they might actually come in and contribute.
You know, Alan, it's tough for museums to make ends meet, even a cool museum like the Atomic Museum. I would imagine that this is the kind of thing that would help keep the doors open.
Well, that certainly is part of our purpose in doing this, and we survive on both donations as well as people coming to visit the museum. But part of the other reason for doing this is to bring people in who might not otherwise come. So not only will they see about Area 51 and learn a lot of things they may not have known, they'll also learn about the struggle of the Cold War detente with the Soviets and that history of the 50s, 60s, 70s. That led to a really tough time in our world. That's a story in its own right that's worth seeing. So this does kind of two things at once.
Well, you don't have to be ashamed about selling that kind of merchandise, because it's stuff that the public wants. If it gets feet in the door and helps people see that atomic part of the museum, that's a good thing. I know that the Las Vegas 51s, the baseball team, before they were the 51s, they did okay. But after they had that alien theme, heck, their merchandise sales went through the roof. So I guess, you know, it's tough times for museums. You got to compete in Las Vegas with shows and all kinds of other attractions. So more power to you.
Well, that's true. And before I forget it, one of the things that we have in this exhibit is a new book written about Area 51 called Groom Lake, by Brian O. And Brian O is a neat young man who's written this book as a novel about Area 51. He told me when he started to write this book, he was going to originally do it as a pure nonfiction work of fact. The more he dug into it, the more he started writing about it, he thought it would be better to use it as a novel because it gave him a little bit more latitude, and he probably also thought no one would be checking through his trash at night.
I don't want to give away too much, but I should mention that, you know, you do touch on Roswell. I mean, that's part of the sort of the legacy of Area 51, Wright-Patterson. SETI would seem to be a natural fit for this thing. I wonder, are they okay, Karen?
Well, yeah, we actually have one of the people from SETI. We filmed. We went out, and he gave us a wonderful interview, not only about what they actually do at SETI, but about the WOW signal.
The WOW signal.
The WOW signal. It's the only unexplained communication that we've ever picked up, and nobody's sure. It's never been repeated. Nobody's sure exactly where it came from, but it is unexplained.
I should say to anybody in our listening audience tonight who worked at Area 51 or who had family members who were out there, or maybe even folks who were stationed at Nellis and had heard stories about the place, feel free to call in and share those tales with us through the course of the evening. We'll be opening up the phone lines here in just a little bit for general kind of discussion. For right now, we're going to our first-time caller, Edward, in Santa Clara, California. Hi, Edward.
Hi, how you doing? I was just wondering if any time in the future there might be an exhibit regarding the face and pyramid-like structures on the Cydonia region of Mars. And I guess Richard Hoagland wanted to talk to with a project like that would be something that could be done in the future.
Karen, you're not including any of that stuff for right now, right?
Not right now, no.
Sorry, Edward. You do intend to perhaps take this on the road for those who can't get to Las Vegas?
You know, it's got an 18-month run right now, and we have had a couple museums inquire about it actually coming out. We're not sure if we'll extend it here, if we will put it out to another museum or not, or if it'll be part of our permanent exhibit. So we're just kind of tossing those around right now.
So you think it might become permanent if it's a big enough hit?
Well, I think, George, it is a natural fit again with the core story of the museum. It just begs to be told. And, yeah, it is our intention to try and work some of that, if not all of it, into the back part of the museum.
East of the Rockies, Chuck in Indiana. Hi, Chuck. Hello?
Sure. Good evening. Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
I wanted to, you said that the museum is actually in Las Vegas?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm planning a trip out to view the Grand Canyon this year, and I'm going to stay in Las Vegas for two nights while I'm out there. What is it? Is it just a daytime operation, or what hours of operation is the museum?
Well, you can find out a lot more about the museum, all the hours, the prices. You can even buy advanced tickets to the new Area 51 exhibit by going to National Atomic Testing Museum.org.
And the museum, the Atomic Testing Museum, is just off the strip. It's about a mile maybe off the strip,
just a little less than a mile.
Yeah, it's easily accessible, so if you come to town, you got to see it. It's a very cool thing. Have you heard the stories, Karen, about Area 51 moving to Utah?
Yeah, I've heard the story that they've moved to Utah. I've heard the story that it's somewhere in New Mexico now. I've heard the story that there's a really secret place in Pennsylvania that they might have moved some of the stuff there. And, of course, you know, the story about the tunnels everywhere. So, you know, connecting half the country underground.
You know, I've heard those stories. I think it was Popular Mechanics, the magazine, went out there, and they went up the wrong road. This is several years ago. Saw a gate that was locked and didn't see anybody around and figured, well, must have moved to Utah. I'm serious. That's the genesis of this story. But, you know, those of us who live here in Las Vegas, you can go to McCarran Airport. There's a special little terminal over there where they fly these unmarked planes with the white with red stripes that fly up to places very near Area 51. And they're packed every day, and the buses still go in and out. You can see the base from a couple of vantage points. They're very busy out there. Would you agree, Alan?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, we're a quarter of a mile on the approach to the south runway at McCarran, and they fly right over the top of us every day. But here's the hoot about this, George. We painted a big sign on our parking structure outside that has the logo for this museum, Area 51, Myth or Reality, right on top of the the parking structure. So when they fly the Janet Airlines right over the top, they look out on the right-hand side and they can see it.
You're going to have to give those guys a group rate or something.
Yeah, I think we're going to talk to them about that.
What kind of programs, Karen, have you got planned that helped promote this thing or sort of round out the experience?
Well, you know, we actually are going to start out on April 3rd with the YF-12A guys, the guys who did the interceptor version of the SR-71 and the A-12. And they're going to actually tell their story for the first time. And then we have aviation historians coming in about Area 51. We have a lot of distinguished lectures through the year. And we have a symposium in the fall, military men who believe in UFOs. So a number of distinguished lectures and lecture series, along with some family fun days for families to come in and learn a little more about Area 51.
You mentioned these military men who are interested or believe in UFOs. Do you happen to know any of those, Karen? I'm not sure if you want to share any personal stories or not, or how far you want to go with that.
Well, you know, my brother is a military man who actually has seen a UFO, and he'll come right out and say it. But the guys who are coming here are people who basically were with Project Blue Book or with the UK version of Project Blue Book, so very high up in the military and very high up in their standings. And they're actually going to talk about the unexplained sightings.
Alan, as you have learned more, I mean, I don't know how much you knew about Area 51 before you started this project, but as you learn more and you see the sort of the quality of people who are interested in this, who take it seriously, military people, people who are in sensitive positions, are you at all surprised?
No, I'm not. And I've actually flown out in Area 51.
Really?
When I was in the Navy flying F-14 Tomcats. I had a couple of occasions to go out to Tonopah and Area 51, Tonopah being Area 52. That's where they operated the MiGs of the Red Eagles, and we would go out there and fly against them right there in the desert over Groom Lake.
Steve, east of the Rockies, Steve in Massachusetts calling in. Steve, what's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I'm a first-time caller. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always been fascinated by the topic of UFOs and extraterrestrials and whatnot. And the whole concept of Groom Lake, Papoose Lake, and all these things, it just amazes me to no end. And when you look at this planet and how it was formed, I mean, just common reason stands to dictate that there are countless other planets that formed the same way that our planet has formed. And when you look... even scientists today, I mean, not too terribly long ago, scientists were saying, well, you know, we're on the hunt for other planets, but there couldn't possibly be planets with other beings like us or similar. But now they've found other planets. So who's to say that there aren't other planets that we haven't been visited before? And then you've got the whole Groom Lake and Area 51 thing. And then not too long ago, there was the disingenuous information from Bob Lazar trying to throw people off. While it's a very clever ploy to try to make people believe this guy, when probably the truth of the matter is there was something somewhere else completely unrelated that Lazar was talking about, where they're doing all kinds of interesting things. But, you know, it just astounds me how a lot of scientists and people out there can't accept the fact that, you know, we aren't the only ones. All you have to do is look up at the stars, and every one of those twinkling lights is the sun. And each one of those suns could have planets. Well, they do have planets, obviously, but how many of them support life, older, younger, whatever, we don't know. But why is it? I mean, I understand that skepticism is healthy, but why is it that they just can't say, okay, it may be possible, it's plausible, they probably have visited us, and it's a shame that we destroy ourselves and we kill each other and we blow each other up, and that's probably why they haven't made contact with us yet. But, you know, what say you on this subject?
Well, I would say that the march of science is sort of a lesson in humility. The more we know about the universe, the less special, the less important we become. You know, it wasn't that long ago in the big picture of time that Earth was the center of the universe, and the more we learn, the less important we become. In fact, we're not only not the center of the universe, we're not even the center of our solar system, that everything doesn't revolve around us. We become less and less special. I think the more we learn about how big it is out there, the less important we become. I mean, it wasn't just a couple of years ago, there were no extrasolar planets. Now there are hundreds of them. And I think that there are many more discoveries of that nature still to come. I do want to address one other thing, and I'll let Karen and Alan respond to your question. That's about Bob Lazar. I've heard that statement about his disinformation and how he was just putting that story out as a way to distract attention from something else that's out there. And I'll just tell you that if that was the strategy, then it was a miserable failure, because as a result of Bob Lazar's stories, the whole world paid attention to Area 51. I mean, it was very not well known at all outside of Nevada before he made those allegations back in 1989. And as a result of his telling those stories, every major news organization in the world has been out there, tens of thousands of people. Even today, every day, there are people out in the desert with binoculars watching the base to see whatever it is that's flying around. So if they wanted to distract attention from something else they had out there, they screwed up. And I would think that somebody got fired as a result of that, because if that was the plan, it was a terrible failure. Alan or Karen, you want to talk about the big picture stuff that Steve mentioned?
Well, the big picture in this, I'm a big fan of Occam's razor, and that is really that other things being equal, a simpler explanation is better than the more complex one. You know, people tend to make very complex assumptions about Area 51. It could very well be that the very simple explanation is we were conducting black programs, things in secret that we wanted to keep secret.
No question. I mean, there's no question we were.
And yet, at the same time, the counter to that is that there's a great deal of evidence that there are unexplained sightings and science that we don't fully understand either. So those things could actually be working in some opposition.
Well, I'll put it this way. If we had some recovered technology and had to take it apart to figure out how it worked, Area 51 is very likely the place they'd take it. I mean, that's where they did reverse engineering, as T.D. Barnes was telling the audience two nights ago. Right, Karen?
That's right. You know, and they reverse engineered the MiGs. And they had to not only take it apart to find out how it flew, but they had to actually build the plane, you know, parts, spare parts for the plane. They had to build the tools because we didn't have them. So you start to look at what they did with the reverse engineering of the MiGs. And so, you know, if we did have that kind of advanced technology, Area 51 would be the place they would do it.
One other quick question, as we're running out of time. This is a sort of an evolving project that it will change. You'll put stuff in and take stuff out over time based on what comes your way.
Yeah, we will. In fact, just tonight, one of the Roadrunners was in there offering us some more artifacts. So things will come in and things will go out. And as things are declassified, as we get more information, as, you know, just it's just going to evolve and evolve.
And Alan, Monday's the big day?
Monday's the big day. And if I could say just this about this exhibit, as we mentioned earlier, it's an experience. And it's one that's full of fact and things we can say, but there's also a lot of ambiguity in it. As Rod Serling used to say, it might be said with a degree of assurance that not everything that meets the eye is as it appears. And that's kind of the secret of this exhibit.
And it's fun. I mean, it's not a dusty old museum. It's fun.
Exactly, it is. And I think people will have a journey of discovery as they come through this. They're gonna have to be challenged to come up with some conclusions of their own.
Well, despite the fact that you've got my big fat face in there at one point, I hope I don't scare any little children. I wish you both luck, and thanks so much for being here with us. Thanks for including me in your project, and I'm sure it's going to be a big hit.
Well, George, it's a pleasure to have you as part of it, and if those questions come in, we'll just blame it on you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you both. That's
thanks,
Commander
Alan, talking to you.
Commander Alan Palmer and Karen Green, both from the Atomic Testing Museum here in Las Vegas, Nevada, talking about their new Area 51 exhibit, which opens to the public on Monday. As mentioned, we've got a video report in our NAPS news section on the Coast to Coast AM website if you want to check that out. Coming back to take your calls, open lines tonight. Hope you got a lot of stuff on your mind. Let's get to it. I'm George Knapp, in for George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM.